Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, patenting human genes. It can sound like a stretch. Can someone really claim an exclusive right to genetic code? Well, yes. About 20% of the human genome is already patented. Supporters say that's necessary to promote innovation. Critics say gene patenting takes property rights too far. Now this debate has gone to court. This hour On Point, the legal battle over patenting the human genome. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Should scientists, corporations be allowed to patent human genes? Does the patent make the profit motive that drives innovation, miracle cures? Or is the genome something that no one should own? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The American Civil Liberties Union and others are suing the U.S. Patent Trademark Office and Myriad Genetics, a biopharmaceutical company based in Salt Lake City, which holds the patent on specific genes linked to breast and ovarian cancer. Joining me first today from Salt Lake City in Utah is Tom Harvey, business reporter for the Salt Lake City Tribune. Tom, thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom.
So the University of Utah, I'm not sure what the right language is, got these genes for BRAC1 and BRAC2, BRCA1, BRCA2, licensed them 15 years ago or so to Myriad. Myriad puts out the tests that women can take to see if they're genetically predisposed to breast and ovarian cancer. Is that right?
That's correct, uh-huh.
That's not cheap. They charge about $3,000 for it. And because they've got the patent on these, they control who does what. What's happening with the courts?
Well, there was a hearing scheduled for today. It's now been postponed until February 2nd, and that is on motions from each side asking the judge to rule in the case, to make a final decision, in essence, in the case. On one side or the other.
The ACLU says, okay, it may have been the law of the land for, 30 years or so now, but it's time to turn it around. And they've got the American Medical Association, American Society of Human Genetics, American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists on their side. What's Myriad's argument for keeping patents on the human genes legal?
Well, on the one hand, they say that the patent on the gene has brought in a lot of money into their company that would be venture capital money that allowed them to to do research and to develop this test and to market this test, and that it wouldn't have been available, at least as early as it was, without that patent and without that ability to attract private capital in to their venture.
If Myriad wins, it goes on, I guess, as now, 20% of the human genome already patented. If they should lose, what are the implications, Tom, for them and other companies that own patents on human genetic code?
Well, it has the potential, if the ruling went that way, to perhaps overturn many of these patents on human genes, and it could really upset this, what has been a rapidly growing industry for almost 30 years.
So this goes before Judge Robert Sweet in New York, maybe sometime early next month now?
That's right. It's set, the hearing on oral arguments is set for February 2nd at this time.
Everybody's asking for it to be, some asking for it to be dismissed on the Myriad side. On the other side, of course, they want to go ahead or just have the law changed. Tom Harvey in Salt Lake City at the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Tom Harvey's a business reporter at the Salt Lake City Tribune. Now, the combatants on this issue. Joining me from New York is Chris Hansen, Senior National Staff Counsel for the ACLU. He's representing the American Civil Liberties Union in the lawsuit against Myriad Genetics and the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. Chris Hansen, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And from Washington, Hans Sauer is with us, Associate General Counsel for Intellectual Property for the Biotechnology Industry Organization, known as BIO, represents 1,200 biotech companies. Prior to joining BIO, he was a PhD research scientist working on age-related neurological disorders. He's co-inventor on 11 U.S. patents himself. Hans Sauer, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Hans, first to you. It's been the law of the land. Tell us, how was it established, 30 years ago now, that genes would be open for patenting?
Genes were allowed to be patented for the same reason that previously patents on naturally derived plant chemicals and other naturally derived substances could be taken out in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. So even though the courts have not ever looked at the particular question of, are DNA molecules that incorporate human sequences patentable, there's been longstanding precedent, and the Patent and Trademark Office, when it first looked at this question, said, well, there's no reason not to grant patents on these because we will treat DNA just like we treated chemicals always. And the law on that has been quite clear. DNA molecules with human nucleotide sequences are patentable under the laws of almost all industrialized countries today, and the law has been clear for a long time in that a naturally occurring gene, just like other things that pre-exist in nature, has never been patentable under any legal system. So in order to be patentable, natural substances like DNA or like plant chemicals, like antibiotics that are isolated from fungus cultures and so on, must be transformed through human intervention into something that is sufficiently different from the natural state to qualify as something new and useful and man-made. And this transformation begins with the purification and isolation of the natural substance. But purifying and isolating it is not enough, because under U.S. law, the claimed invention must be sufficiently different from the natural thing, not just in degree, but in kind, in quality. And that begins not just with the isolation and purification, but the scientist must have given the natural substance through his work new qualities and new uses and utilities that are not possessed by the natural thing. So you basically have to create something new and man-made that may be analogous to nature, but that can't be the same thing that was found in nature. That's never been patentable.
So you're saying by the time it's patented, it's been extracted and isolated and purified and made something different. It's not just the handiwork of nature here. Let me get Chris Hansen in here. Chris, what's your argument against the patenting of the human genome?
Well, I'm pleased to discover that it appears we agree on what the legal principles are here. Everyone has known for 100 years, or maybe even longer, that you cannot patent something, a product of nature, a law of nature, an abstract idea. You can't patent equals MC squared. You can't patent gravity. You can't patent gold or iron. All of those things are not creations of people. They're creations of nature. And as a result, they have long been held unpatentable. And the reason for that is we don't really want to patent the most basic elements of nature. Those are too valuable in some ways and can be used in too many different ways, so we don't want them patented. And that's been the rule for a very long time. About a few years ago, the Patent Office veered off and stopped applying that principle and started patenting things that were, in fact, products of nature or laws of nature or abstract ideas. And one of the places where they erred was in patenting the human gene. What you need to understand is that what Myriad does with the genes that it has patented is it simply takes them out of the body and looks at them. There isn't any transformation. The gene that they are looking at in the lab is absolutely identical to the gene in your body. Indeed, Myriad's entire business would make no sense if that were not true. Here's what Myriad actually does. You send a sample of your DNA to Myriad, and they will then look at it to see whether there are any mutations in your DNA that correlate with an increased risk of breast or ovarian cancer. It's true they're looking at the DNA that you've sent them in the sample, but what they're trying to figure out is what's going on in your body. What does the DNA in your body look like? And so if the DNA in the lab is different than the DNA in the body, they can't actually do that job.
We'll talk about the legal principle here and what goes on there. I want to go back to Hans, but first let me just put it to you. What's the problem? Hans Sauer says, well, we do transform it. I'm sure he'll assert that again. But functionally, what's the problem with this, Chris? I can well imagine people saying, how could anybody own the recipe of life? That's God's work, not man's work. Practically speaking, what problems do you see here? We'll look at principle as well.
Oh, there are a lot of practical problems. I represent four national associations of physicians and pathologists who are willing to offer genetic testing to women throughout the country and are prohibited from doing so by Myriad. There are a lot of women who can't afford the cost of the Myriad testing.
$3,000 or so.
$3,000 or more, depending upon what form of the Myriad testing you get. Women who want a second opinion can't get a second opinion. Myriad won't let anybody else do the test. They claim it's their gene, and therefore nobody else can actually give you a second opinion as to whether you have an increased risk of breast or ovarian cancer. If you're a woman who's trying to make a very serious medical decision, sometimes a very serious surgical decision about your health, you might want a second opinion. Myriad says, tough, you can't have it.
Hans Sauer, if the court turns back this policy that's been there for some time now of allowing the patenting of human genes, what will the implications be for the biotechnology industry in this country?
I think that's one of the really important aspects of the lawsuit, in that it is short-sighted in trying to strike at these two particular patents and at this particular company, which is not a bio member, by the way. They are striking at all patent holders in biotechnology. Patents on isolated and purified DNA substances don't only protect genetic testing technology, which is, you know, in the crosshairs in this lawsuit. These patents don't say on their face what kind of technology they protect and what they be useful for. In many cases, gene patents protect not genetic tests, but they protect actual medicines and actual therapeutics, which for their development require an investment of $1.2 billion over the course of 10 years reach the marketplace.
Please hold that thought. We have to take a short break right here. We'll be right back with Hans Sauer from Bio, Chris Hansen from the ACLU. We're talking about a big legal fight over patenting human genes. Should your genetic code be open to patenting? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a big legal fight over patenting human genes. Drug companies are doing it. Opponents say the human genome should not be patented. Chris Hansen joins us from the ACLU. They're challenging the kind of standing law on patenting genes. 20% of the human genome already patented. He joins us from New York. We're joined from Washington by Hans Sauer. He's Associate General Counsel for Intellectual Property at the Biotechnology Industry Organization, BIO, big industry group. They say, watch out, you will kill innovation if you kill the profit motive on this new emerging front of genetic medicine. Hans Sauer, I'm sorry I had to cut in there for the break, but the bottom line, if this legal path is turned against the patenting of genetic code, what happens to the pharmaceutical biotech industry?
Well, you only have to look at the kinds of products that have been developed in reliance on patents on such DNA molecules. We today have products that are used to screen our blood supply for infection with hepatitis C or the HIV virus. We have products like erythropoietin for cancer sufferers who can't make their own red blood cells. We have products like growth hormone for children who can't make their own, and blood clotting factors for hemophiliacs. So, you know, when Chris is talking about this particular genetic testing technology, what I don't think he has in mind is the huge investment and the benefits for patients and the benefits for science that have come from the investment that's been made possible in reliance on such patents.
Chris
Hansen,
striking
down such patents is going to have quite unintended consequences, I believe.
How do you see that, Chris? Principle on the one hand, perhaps, and on the other, the consequences for patients. Is there a trade-off here?
Well, the fact that I represent most of the medical establishment of this country and that people like the AMA are supporting our position would suggest that cries from industry that this is going to hurt patients is probably misguided. And it's not. The truth is there are a lot of expert geneticists around the country who can do the testing that Myriad does, who can do it cheaper and even better, and Myriad is preventing that from occurring. It is not the case that new drugs will not be patented if we are successful in this lawsuit. New drugs will still be patented. New therapeutic techniques will still be patented. New methods of looking at the gene or doing other things with the gene can still be patented.
But without the incentive of owning it and the profit motive that's embedded in that, are people going to put the money into the research necessary to come up with those products?
You still have the incentive of getting the patent over the drug. And so you can put all the money you want into getting into developing the drug. What you can't have is the basic things that nature created. You can't patent what nature created. You can only patent what humans created. We know that the incentive here was not necessary for Myriad. There were several other labs all over the country looking for the BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene. They were all just about as close as Myriad was to finding it. Some of them had already announced that if they found it, they would not patent it. They would let the entire world use their discovery. It was Myriad that happened to find it first. As a result of finding it first, Myriad locked up the patent and since then has prevented anybody else from looking at this very basic piece of the human genome. We also know that there are women who need to be tested, who ought to be tested, who can't be tested because of Myriad's monopoly power. We know that only about half of the states, their Medicaid programs will pay for testing. We know that a large number of insurance companies won't pay for testing. And so there are women today who need medical testing, and because of Myriad's patent, they can't get it.
Hans Sauer, is it true that Myriad will not allow other scientists to look at these very important bits of genetic code? Are they really locked away and for Myriad only?
Well, first of all, all the problems that you've described about access to testing and so on occur also in other genetic testing areas where the test is not patented or where the test is provided by multiple providers who have non-exclusive licenses. So it has nothing to do with Myriad's patent.
But there is a monopoly here that allows high pricing.
There's a monopoly here that allows pricing. However, you know, it's been studied. There was a recent study by Duke University that actually compared the price of Myriad's testing to the price of other comparable tests that are not patented or not exclusively licensed, and found that Myriad's test actually is not, when you take into account the amount of sequencing work that goes into it, more expensive than comparable tests.
Does Myriad keep these stretches of code open for the world to do research on, or not?
Myriad has never asserted, to my knowledge, its patent against scientists who do basic research. You only need to look at the National Library of Medicine's database and type in the keywords BRCA1 or BRCA2 and look at the amount of basic research that has been published ever since these genes were first published in the scientific literature in 1994. You will find thousands of papers of scientists who have published, and I very much doubt that they all had to obtain licenses from Myriad for that.
Chris Hansen, that doesn't sound like a lockdown, Chris.
Oh, well, it's definite. First of all, we need to distinguish between clinical and research. There's unquestionably a complete and total lockdown on clinical testing, which is what we're really talking about, women getting the results. But Myriad has never publicly announced that people can do research on the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. It's true they haven't sued everybody who's done research, but they have the authority under the patent law, given the way the patent system works, to stop all research. In fact, they have the authority under the patent law to prevent anybody from using their gene and not to use it themselves. We also know that Myriad defines research very tightly. If, for example, you are doing a research program and you're testing women as part of the research program, Myriad says you can't tell the women the results that you receive on their own samples. So we know that Myriad is, in fact, locking up some degree of the research and locking up all of the clinical practice.
But they have to know the results to make the test worthwhile.
The research is allowed to know the results. The research is not allowed to tell the woman what the results were. So we know that Myriad is locking up all clinical practice and some research, and we know there are women who need to get tested who can't be tested, and if these patents were invalidated, they could be tested.
Let's go to Rick in Lexington, Massachusetts, calling in. Rick, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Before I make my comments, I want to point out that a bit of my own background. I actually am a biotech research scientist and manager, mm-hmm. And I have more than a handful of patents, both on human genes and genes from other species. I think, in retrospect, that patenting of human genes as they come out of the sequencers is a bad idea. I want to add a few business and scientific considerations to the discussion here. First of all, there are three myths, I believe. One is the myth of cost. When you look at all the costs the companies have to put in to defend their patents in terms of legal fees, mm-hmm. business fees, it actually, for most biotechnology companies, turns out to be a money loser or a very tiny profit at best.
Okay.
Myriad is an exception. Number two, innovation. These patents stifle innovation.
Why?
I can tell you from the ground level that mm-hmm. whenever a scientist working in basic research or applied research discovers a new gene by whatever means that's important for a process, the first thing that they do these days is go and look if it's patented. I can tell you that that often creates an opportunity cost, that the scientist looks at it and says, oh my gosh, this big guy's patented it. It's going to constrain their research in some way.
So they veer away from it, you're saying, and don't bother to plunge on in?
Veer away from it, or at least veer away from some aspect of research on it that could be useful.
Okay, and third?
The third thing is that when the biorepresentative talks about the genes are what's patented in terms of erythropoietin, et cetera, that's really not correct. What it, the therapeutic there that goes out there to the blood, the EPO that goes out there, is the basic human gene as it comes out of the sequence, but it also consists of other elements that had to be added on. In that sense, the human gene is like a screw that goes into something larger that's actually patented, but not the screw. In the case of EPO, you have to put things in to make it work. That, indeed, is an innovation. That's a new thing, new to the world, new to science. Not the EPO gene itself.
So, Rick, you're in the field, and you're against it, but I noticed you said you own some patents on human genes yourself. Why don't you just put them out in the public domain?
Well, because I don't own them. Because of the way this works, as an employee, I turn over all rights to those, having worked in the biotechnology corporate world.
Mm-hmm. Hans Sauer, what do you say to our biotech scientist who has developed some patents himself and says they shouldn't be?
It all depends on which setting you're in. The patents, the way you look at patents depends on your perspective of where you are in the research and development chain. It is probably true that basic research, doesn't need to be motivated by patents. You know, genes are discovered, basic research is done, and you don't particularly probably need patents to motivate scientists to do that. Scientists are motivated by all kinds of things, and patents are, if any factor, a minor factor in that. What patents are critically necessary for is transforming the basic discoveries of the laboratory that are done at universities and research institutions in this country into real-life products that benefit patients and providers and consumers later on, 10 years down the road. So again, it's really the D in the R&D that depends on the patent incentive. I've worked for a number of, these struggling small biotech companies, which is the vast majority of biotech companies in this country. And I can tell you that when we approached venture capitalists, when we approached people who might have had the funds to support our product development, we asked them, will you support the development of our drug? Mm-hmm. The first thing they're asking for is, do you have patents? What's your patent portfolio? What's your freedom to operate? What's your intellectual property position? And if that's not right, then the company stops dead in its tracks. There are so many valuable programs.
And the funding's not
there. This country.
Let me take that to Rick, if I may. Caller Rick, what about it? Without that kind of funding that comes to holding the property rights on the human genome, you're not going to have the advances on the therapeutics.
Well, I think you have to look at it as a net phenomenon. I think the fact that companies have to go to the lengths to do the patent background work and all the business development work to stake out the defense of intellectual property or the aggressive counterattack is something that for most companies either ends up leading them to spend more money than they think they're going to have to or just abandoning the work.
Rick, Tom, if I can.
Yes, Rick, thanks for your call. Chris Hansen?
What we know with respect to the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes is that Hans's argument is just factually inaccurate. There were people doing BRCA1 and BRCA testing prior to Myriad getting its patent. What happened then was Myriad shut those testing programs down. Myriad not only didn't increase the amount of testing that was available to women, Myriad affirmatively decreased the amount of testing that was available to women. And that, in addition to that, we know that the other researchers who were looking for the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes had already announced that they were, if they found it first, they were going to make sure that the entire world was able to do the testing. What happened?
Chris.
Myriad found it first, and Myriad shut down the testing. So
Hans
we
Sauer?
Know that the development got worse, not better.
Hans?
Chris, I think you're wrong on two points. First of all, the search for the BRCA gene early on involved patent considerations. There were groups other than the Utah group, which actually took out patents on markers that were discovered earlier, which later, that was the California group, which ended up in the hands of OncroMed, a competing company, which indeed was a company that later competed for a while with Myriad on BRCA testing. But, you know, more importantly, when you look at Myriad and when you talk to them, they have invested over $200 million in making the BRCA test as widely available in this country as is humanly possible. I very much doubt that any of these other few labs that were providing BRCA testing at the time the patents were finally issued would have gone to that kind of investment, patient education, physician education, all the negotiations with the state Medicaid and Medicare agencies to make this test as widely available as possible and as it is today. I think, you know, it's almost, if I were Myriad, I would find your statement offensive that Myriad reduced the availability of BRCA testing. And the insinuation is that a company like Myriad is using its patent affirmatively to bar women from access to health care, which is an absurd assertion.
Let me get a call right here from Ithaca, New York. Faye, you're on the air.
Hello. Yeah, hi. I'm very concerned about this because I see this connected with a lot of other different things. First of all, you know, I agree with Chris Hansen, and I really appreciate everything he said and he's doing, and keep it up, because I think it's very important that we stop this proprietary kind of stuff.
Why?
Happening.
Why?
Oppressing or let me give you a couple examples. First of all, Monsanto. Monsanto is buying up all the seeds and the rights. It's destroying the small farmer. It's destroying our rights in terms of what we eat. Let me give you another example. Look at what happened with the banking, with the whole lending to the banks. The banks said, if we don't have this money from the government, then we, for example, the bonuses, if we don't give bonuses to our employees, then we'll lose them. I mean, think of the outrage that people have had. It's all, this is the same. The insurance company, it's proprietary, it's corrupt, and that's why
Faye, we've got the perspective quite clearly. Thank you very much for your call. Chris Hansen, Faye's applauding your work, but how will this work? You've got one of the parties to your suit. I'm reading here Dan Ravisher at the Public Patent Foundation is saying that it's absolutely our intent, he says, that upon victory in the courts, he's hoping, assuming, this will rend invalid patents on many other genes. He said we just had to pick one case as our case, but if you take patents over all that 20% that's already, you know, take those away from the 20% of the genome that's covered, what happens to product development, to therapeutic development? Does it really work if the proprietary piece that Faye bemoans is taken out, Chris?
Oh, I think, in fact, it has a very positive impact. If you take away patents on basic elements, if you take away patents on things in the periodic table or patents on gravity or patents on E equals MC squared, what happens is you get an explosion of scientific interest in those things. People are very interested in the human genome. People are going to be developing drugs, but based on the human genome, and that's a good thing. But what the way it works now is nobody can do that with respect to the BRCA1 or BRCA2 genes or with respect to the other patented genes. Scientists are locked out of the ability to develop a new drug based on BRCA1 or BRCA2 because Myriad owns it, and nobody else is allowed to use Myriad's possession. And I think, therefore, we will have an explosion of new techniques, new treatments, new drugs.
And the $200 million that Hans Sauer said has been put into developing this and getting the word out about it?
Yeah, the Myriad itself describes that $200 million as essentially their advertising budget. And frankly, if the patent system is necessary for an advertising budget, then there's something wrong with the patent system.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a big legal fight over patenting human genes. Drug companies are doing it. 20% of the human genome already covered by U.S. patents. Opponents say the human genome should not be patented. Chris Hansen is here from the ACLU. They want to turn around standing law on this. Hans Sauer is here from the biotechnology industry organization that is defending current U.S. practice on this front. Here's a couple of comments from Facebook. We've got Ian saying gene patenting is corporate megalomania and hubris spray painted right on G-D's face. Chris says if someone spends millions of dollars researching what a gene does, looking for a cure for a disease, shouldn't they be able to at least recoup their investment? Let's get a call from New York City. Jin, you're on the air, Jin.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment on the fact that this just highlights a more systemic thing that's going on with the research and development in this country. Historically, research and development has been happening in universities with public grants, and the fact that a lot of this research and development, when it comes out of taxpayer money, it gets handed over for these corporations and this corporation like Myriad for private profit. And this is just one of these things that gets highlighted when it's in the news, but it's really systemic. It happens with our all of the bio industry. It happens with weapons research. And I just wanted to get
public research migrating into the private realm. Jen, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Chris Hansen, I'm wondering, though, if you should win. I mean, we're headed into a century where, after industry being focused on mechanics, we're headed into biomechanics, where nature itself is, we're told, going to be the raw material and source for a whole lot of innovation in the century ahead. I mean, does it mean a whole overturning of the patent system and profit and research motives as we've known them? If you put genetics off limits, is it only human genetics you're talking about, or would it be all genetics? How widely would you blow up the fences?
This case is not revolutionary in the slightest. All this case does is try to apply a very long-standing principle of patent law, which is you can't patent a product of nature. Patents are designed to incentivize, to reward people who actually invent something, people who make something. Human genes are not made by scientists. And to say to a scientist, you can have a patent on something even though you didn't make it, even though you didn't invent it, is simply wrong.
But
if you invent something, you can have a patent. If you create something that never existed before, you can have a patent. That will continue to happen, and that will be helpful. But what you can't do is patent something just because it exists in nature.
But if nature itself becomes the field of innovation more than ever, more directly than ever, it's just fascinating. Wendy Chung joins us now from New York. She's director of clinical genetics at Columbia University. She's also with Chris Hansen, a plaintiff in the ACLU versus Myriad Genetics case. Wendy Chung, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You're a research scientist in this field. You're someone who yourself holds patents. You hold patents on a gene. So where do you stand on this?
So I am, one of the other hats I wear is I'm also a clinical geneticist providing care to patients who are concerned about their risk of, for instance, in this case, breast or ovarian cancer, and actually use this in terms of testing. And one of the things that's the greatest issue is not just, in fact, the patents themselves, but this idea of exclusive licenses with the patents. And really, that's part of the issue here, even beyond just the patents themselves, that there are other ways that potentially universities can even deal with patents and issue non-exclusive licenses so that multiple, in this case, for instance, diagnostic companies could use this to be able to make clinical genetic testing available to patients.
But net, do you think it encourages research on the human genome to have patents sitting out there across the horizon or not?
Well, it certainly is an incentive for the researchers that are trying to make discoveries into diseases, the underlying basis for diseases and that genetic factor. And so it certainly acts as that carrot within that the particular way that incentivizes researchers, be they in the private or the public sector, to go forth and do this. But again, the issue is that if this creates a situation that's a monopolistic situation, then I think there are market forces that come to bear that discourage innovation and improvement, providing the consumer, in this case patients, with really the best product.
Because other scientists are cut off from diving into this, to the research of patent-protected genes.
Or being able to move and translate this into something that can actually be useful. So in this particular case, translating it into, for instance, a diagnostic test for patients. In other cases, translating it into therapy. But again, building upon this to make something that actually benefits patients.
So it seems like you see both sides, but you've joined with Chris Hansen as a plaintiff here to try and remove some of this patent protection. Why?
Because ultimately, from my point of view, again, acting as the physician that takes care of many of these women who are sitting in this situation, it really, by having, again, a single provider because of the patents that have been set up and lack of having multiple laboratories for them to go to, it set up a situation where I don't think there's really the best of all possible worlds for them. In the early days when testing for BRCA1 and 2 was first available, this was a very expensive test. It was over $3,000. Myriad didn't have contracts with insurance companies, so there were very few women who actually had $3,000 to lay out for this test. And by having only a single laboratory providing this, there have been the innovations and the improvements in this test have been stifled, and frankly, we've been stuck with a mediocre test at some times that wasn't as good as it could have been, even though scientists out there had identified ways of improving the test and making it better. And again, it was because there wasn't this competitive force to be able to make things better.
Is there a middle ground somewhere here, Wendy Cho?
So, like I said, in my opinion, there are multiple ways to solve this problem. Again, there are, you know, people think about things like patent pools in some cases. People think about non-exclusive licenses. People think about, you know, going to the point of just not having patents whatsoever. But I think what's clear to me is having situations that set up where only one person or one organization can benefit from this is certainly not something that ultimately helps individuals, helps the consumer, helps patients.
Wendy Chung, Director of Clinical Genetics at Columbia University. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hans Sauer, what about non-exclusive licenses or patent pools? It would give some claim, but not a single claim.
Yes, and you know, these practices are actually existing today. What we often see, so recently at Bio, we've had a big survey of our members asking them, you know, what kinds of licensing arrangements do you actually prefer when you in-license basic discoveries from universities for the purpose of then translating those into real-life products, into product development? And the answer was, from our member companies, that depends. There is usually and often a preference for the ability to obtain an exclusive license, especially when the development of a therapeutic product is at stake, which requires significantly more and longer investment than the development of a diagnostic product. It is often the case that for diagnostic purposes, genetic inventions are non-exclusively licensed, so that is not uncommon. Sometimes they are not, and that just very much depends on a case-to-case basis on the situation of the licensee, the university, the kind of technology that gets developed, and also whether the technology is going to be suitable for development not only as a diagnostic, but also as a therapeutic or other product. So I think it varies. What we must maintain, probably, in this system is the flexibility to actually do the best thing with any best given piece of technology that becomes available through basic research for product development.
Chris Hansen, are you looking for a middle ground here, Chris? Would you be open to, you know, patent pools, non-exclusive licenses, or do you want just a free field?
Well, we're certainly open to virtually any option that would change the current situation. But what is critical here is that the patent law, the authority given to Myriad under the patent law, or the authority given to any patent holder on the patent law, says, I have exclusive control over my invention, even though it's not an invention. I can prevent anybody else from doing it. In fact, I don't even have to use it myself. Myriad, once having gotten the patent on the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, could have simply stuck that patent in the drawer and could have prohibited anyone else from looking at the gene and not looked at the gene themselves. There's something wrong with patent law that allows a fundamental piece of the human body to be owned by a private company and locked away. And that's just simply wrong. We need to find a way to fix that problem.
And you're making an argument here not just on property rights, but actually you're making a First Amendment argument as well.
That's correct. One of the things that Myriad has patented is looking at two genes to see if they are the same or to see if they are different. So that what really happens is Myriad takes your sample and they sequence it. That is, they spread it out in such a way that they can look at it. And then they take what they know to be a normal gene, one that doesn't have any mutations, and they look at the two to see if they're exactly the same or if they're different. The only thing that Myriad has really patented is looking at the two samples and thinking to yourself, aha, they're the same, or aha, they're different. In our view, the First Amendment prohibits the patenting of thought. This is one of the few instances, one of the very rare instances we know of, where the Patent Office has granted a patent on pure thought. And in our view, that's not only a violation of patent law, it's also a violation of the First Amendment.
Let's go to Buffalo, New York, and Mike. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been in the patent territory for more years than we want to count, and have obtained patents in the area of genetics.
As an attorney, Mike, as a lawyer, or what?
As an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And there are long lines of cases going back long before I was born, which was quite a long time, that articles of nature may not be patented. If the person that first discovered coal, if there had been a patent system, could not patent it. That doesn't mean that you're foreclosing patents in the area of genetics. The example of Monsanto was given earlier. That was not a patent on a gene itself. That was a patent on a modified genetic structure.
But, Mike, our industry rep, Hans Sauer, says it's not a gene itself. It's an isolated and purified DNA substance.
Yeah, that's the problem. I mean, I'm not familiar. Actually, I have to tell you, I'm not familiar with the patents we're talking about. There's so many patents in these areas that nobody can know what they are. If the Patent Office issued a patent on the gene itself, I'd be surprised by that. And if that's what the litigation's about, I think I would rather be on the side that would say that patent is held invalid.
Yeah, Mike, thanks for your call. Hans Sauer, as we move into a century of genetic medicine, I mean, one of the concerns raised here is that 20% of the human genome is already patented, and that's a lot of patents, 20 or 30,000, I recall. If we get that many, you know, times five or times I don't know how many, if it's all sliced up in little bits of ownership, it may ultimately be difficult to do the kind of holistic analysis, diagnostics, therapeutics, as we come to understand genetic medicine better and better. There may be so many people who own a piece of this turf that it will be hard to do the kind of overarching work that the medicine may suggest is best once it really gets developed.
Well, you have to look at what's actually going on in genetics research and in the biotech industry with respect to applied research right now. The concern that you've described, you know, the tragedy of the anti-commons as it's been described, a splitting up of the human genome into many different owners that then makes it impossible to do research on the whole, that concern has been around for over 20 years. What we typically see in the commercial space is that companies work out rational solutions to these kinds of problems, and that so far genetic research and also development of genetic-based inventions has been proceeding fairly well. What we are seeing in this country at the same time and in parallel is both an explosion of genetic research that appears to be unimpeded by the practice of granting patents on DNA molecules, and we're also seeing one of the most successful biotechnology industries in the whole wide world. I mean, it's undisputed that the United States biotechnology basis, both commercial and academic and research-based, is internationally in by far a leading position. So I think even though the concern is interesting and worth studying and worth discussing on a theoretical basis, so far what we're lacking is the real empirical evidence that these things are actually taking place. To the contrary, what we're seeing is that all the actors in this space are sufficiently motivated to work these things out and grant each other access when it's in their interest to do so. And it usually is for the purpose of developing products and making technology available.
Chris Hansen, what about that argument that it's a hypothetical problem on the ground, not really a problem?
Well, I don't think it's accurate, but I also don't think it's relevant. It's not accurate because the more basic elements of nature that are locked up and that scientists can't use, the more, by definition, we're going to impede research and impede scientific advances. It's also not relevant because the patent law gives all of these companies the authority to intrude in any way they want to. And for the industry to say, oh, yes, we have the authority to make things a whole lot worse, but don't worry, just trust us, I think is inadequate, an inadequate answer. And it's an inadequate answer, particularly in a situation like the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, where we know that there are women who can't afford the test, where we know that there are women who want a second opinion and can't get a second opinion, where we know that there is information about these genes that has not been revealed, that would have been revealed if it hadn't been for the existence of the patent. We know that there has been an impedance. I'm not sure that's a word. We know that that the patents have made things worse, both in research and clinical terms.
If the ruling goes your way, Chris, what's it going to look like out there in this world of genetic medicine? If the ruling ultimately goes your way,
I don't think there. As I said earlier, I think what will happen is that there will be a vast increase in the amount of genetic research that takes place, and a vast increase in the number of new tests and new drugs that are developed. What we want is to give more scientists the ability to look at these genes and more scientists the availability of trying to tinker with them and figure out what works and what doesn't work. And I think that's all to the plus.
Hansaro, we've just got half a minute here. What do you see? If the ruling goes against Myriad, if it goes against your industry position, what do you fear?
Well, I have expressed that fear before. What I think is going to happen is that we will lose a significant incentive to develop products like recombinant human growth hormone, insulin, erythropoietin, and other new therapies that we haven't even thought of today for the benefit of patients who are still waiting. Chris represents women who are waiting for a breast cancer test that, for one reason or another, that relates not to the patents but to our healthcare system, may not be available to them as easily as he would hope it is. And what he's not talking about are all the patients who are today waiting for cures that we haven't even imagined. I don't know if Chris wants to take the risk that such inventions lie barren because patents on them won't be granted. Hmm. But for one, I know that BIOS members
Hans Sauer at BIO, Chris Hansen at the ACLU, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.